that he would enjoy fellowshipping with, and they're good men of God and women of God in the movement, and we support wholeheartedly the Christian Exodus. So, but even having said that, remember, folks, we can have a few disagreements between us and still be in the same group. It doesn't mean that because we're a Christian worldview listener, we all have to agree 100% on the same things. We do have some differences of opinion on how to handle things like immigration or the problem with illegal immigration, I should say. How do we handle the war on drugs problem? Some people disagree over that issue. There are several other things which are of relative minor importance compared to the overall picture of agreement, and we sometimes can major on those things, and people get the impression that, well, hey, these are the most important things, and there's division in the camp. No, it's not the case at all. I just like to apologize, to Corey again publicly for the comments I had made yesterday, because I think for some people they sounded, who are especially quite sensitive, and maybe for good reason, sounded maybe like there was some division in the camp, and there certainly is not. Corey has given me a free rein to go ahead and mention his name on the air in conjunction with his emails that he writes. He's not ashamed of what he writes, and he's interested in debating some of these issues. And just to confirm that, yesterday we spoke on the phone. So in case anybody was wondering yesterday what was going on with Corey and I, in case there was any concern about it, just to let you know that we stand fully behind Christian Exodus. And again, I just wanted to make a public apology so that people know where I stand with Corey. And in the future, we'll try to keep it a little more down to earth, in the sense that there's no confusion about where we stand as a united front against the evils of our age. So I wanted to get that done this morning, and appreciate your listening to the show. If you have a phone call this morning, give us a jingle at 864-244-8177. That's 864-244-8177. And you can also try our backup line, 864-201-6955. It's the 20th day of June today, isn't it? 20th day of June, 2005. What's that? My producer's telling me something.
July.
Oh, is it July today? Oh, you see, I think it's still June. That's my problem. I'm still back another month. I haven't caught up for this whole month of work yet. Well, here's something that can help you catch up with. It's the second consecutive Institute on the Constitution meeting. And this is for five consecutive Saturdays, August 6th, 13th, 20th, 27th, September 3rd, from 8:30 to noon, hosted by Bible Baptist Church, 2522 Gentry Memorial Highway, that's Highway 8 in Pickens, South Carolina. And you can call Mark Dibbler at area code 864-421-2714 if you want to talk to somebody about registering or about attending there, and I hope that you will be able to attend if you have not been to the Institute on the Constitution. We have a caller on the line. We want to take a quick call here. Welcome to Christian Worldview. Who am I speaking with? Hello, welcome to Christian Worldview. Who am I speaking with? Well, we're trying to get you on the air here. Can you hear us?
I can hear you just fine.
Okay, good. Well, we've got you now. Welcome to Christian Worldview.
Hey, good morning.
Oh, this sounds like Chuck.
It is, yes, thank you.
Well, good. Thanks for joining us this morning, Chuck. How are things for you out there, and what's on your mind?
Well, they're pretty good. I was traveling different places. I noticed that we were missing the signal in Greer earlier, but it's back, and it's good on Augusta Road, so it's nice being able to hear you clearly this morning.
Yeah, I was thinking there was some technological problems this morning right when the show started. It looked like they got repaired, though, so I was glad to hear that.
Yes, it's very encouraging. Listen, I was also reading in the paper about this new Supreme Court justice nominee,
right,
Roberts, and one of the things he said intrigued me. I wanted to get your opinion about it. He said that, referring to Roe v. Wade, and that's now established law, and it made me wonder if there's really a very strict rule against the current Supreme Court overruling something that an earlier Supreme Court had ruled on. I know they try to avoid that.
Yeah, well, the idea of stare decisis, let the decision stand, is a legal, a very important legal part of our legal system. And what they essentially are saying there is, look, unless we have a really good reason to overrule the past, we're not going to do it. And that's typically the way the common law works. However, in the case of federal law or federal cases like this, since there is no common law, no federal common law, I should say, it's all state run, it doesn't seem to me that notion has to necessarily apply. And not only that, the Supreme Court has reversed itself before us on many different issues. And so we have to expect that it can do it again, especially on a fundamental rights issue like this. But I also find that Roberts, you know, he did write in this case, as brief he did years ago, that I was reading this last night, that he opposed Roe v. Wade and he thought it was a mistake. And so you know, conservatives are behind him now thinking that he's going to actually do well. It is a surprise choice. I'll be surprised to see if he actually does anything for the cause of liberty and truth just because Bush is appointing him. But, hey, it's entirely possible, and I'll be very happy if it's indeed the case.
Yes, I'll be very interested to see how that comes out. I think he has to be very careful, too, about what he says before he goes for confirmation.
Yeah, that's right. And maybe he's playing that game where he's trying to be careful. You know, there's a lot of Republicans that aren't going to like him either. And so here's an opportunity, I suppose, for this man, Roberts, to actually come forward and say what he can to the Senate and hopefully get confirmed. But we'll see. Maybe I just don't have a lot of hope or optimism, really, about George Bush's appointments, but I'm willing to be very pleasantly surprised.
Sure. Sounds like we could do a lot worse, though. I've heard mostly good things so far about this nominee.
Yeah, and really there's not a whole lot to say about him. He's sort of a guy we don't know a lot about. But the same thing was true about Kennedy and Souter, as I recall. Everybody thought they would be more conservative, socially conservative justices, and in effect, they were not. They ended up being quite on the opposite side of things. I believe both of those guys voted against Kelo and the people that own property up in the city of New London recently.
Yeah, it's a risky business.
Yeah, sure is. Anyhow.
Listen, good talking to you.
Okay.
Have a good day.
Thanks a lot, Chuck. Appreciate the call.
Welcome. Bye.
And we're listening to Christian Worldview with Dr. John Coben. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a minute.
Warning. Dr. Coben's show is not recommended for anyone with an aversion to deep thinking and critical analysis.
Are you interested in knowing about the faith and legacies of Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson? Check out Warriors of Honor. It's a new DVD produced by New Liberty Videos. You can get a copy of this video by emailing the Tyranny Response Network production staff at production@policyofliberty.net. That's production@policyofliberty.net. It's only $20, and it's well worth it. Take it from me, Dr. John Coben. I've seen this video, Warriors of Honor. It is just outstanding in producing something of value for those who love liberty, who hold to the Christian perspective, and want to be encouraged about our past. Finally, a documentary that is willing to speak plainly about the Christian faith of Jackson and Lee. It is a beautiful and accurate account of two great Southern leaders and a war that forever changed our country. Steve Wilkins.
Albert Einstein once said, "Unthinking respect for authority is the greatest enemy of truth."
Hi, this is Dr. John Coben. Is it okay for a Christian to become wealthy? Did you know that 8 out of 10 Americans will face retirement with little or no savings, even Americans who had good incomes? At Integrity Group, we are dedicated to providing personalized service, finding effective ways to protect and increase your hard-earned money. Integrity Group is an independent financial planning firm that offers a wide range of services. We specialize in finding creative, custom solutions to meet the needs of each individual. Do you have concerns about providing for your retirement? Do you want to ensure that catastrophes like disability or long-term care will not wipe out your savings? Do you need to have your assets protected from creditors? Do you want tax-advantaged growth of your savings? At Integrity Group, we recognize that time passes all too quickly. Sound financial planning is not something to be delayed. Our offices are located at 514 Pettigrew Street in downtown Greenville. Make an appointment with Integrity Group today at 864-244-6464. That's 864-244-6464.
If you have a question or comment for the show, please dial 864-244-8177. That's 864-244-8177. You may also dial 864-201-6955. That's 864-201-6955. or you may email your question or comment to questions@policyofliberty.net. That's questions@policyofliberty.net. And remember, the show is live from 7:30 in the morning until 9 in the morning Eastern Time. If you're listening at any other time you're listening to a recording, calls will only be received between 7:30 and 9 in the morning Eastern Time. Thomas Jefferson said, "Sometimes it is said that man cannot be trusted with the government of himself. Can he then be trusted with the government of others? Or have we found angels in the forms of kings to govern him? Let history answer this question."
You're listening to TRN, the Tyranny Response Network, where we comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable.
Let me welcome you back to Christian Worldview with Dr. John Coben. Here, PETA is in the news. The People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals keeps getting wackier, or maybe it's just trying to take attention away from serious charges that have been leveled against it for having to do with murdering the many animals in its care. Its latest stunt is to demand that the town of Fishkill, New York, change its name. Oh, yes, you got the name like Fishkill. That's bad. Don't want to say anything about killing fish. And so PETA, the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, this wacky group, wants to change their name. Well, are you tired of politicians who raise taxes, invade your privacy, and assume that you don't have the sense to make your own decisions? Try voting libertarian for a change. Would you like to meet other libertarians? You'll find there are regular people like you concerned about the state of our republic and willing to act on that concern. Our business meeting is at 6:30 p.m. the second Thursday of the month at the Malden branch of the Greenville County Library, and that's down on Butler Road. Visitors are welcome. To talk politics, join us for the meetup at 8 p.m. on the fourth Wednesday of the month. That's next week. It's at Cafe Underground just off of Main Street downtown Greenville. We would love to swap ideas with you for restoring limited constitutional government. Thank you for supporting the Libertarian Party and Christian Worldview on the Tyranny Response Network. And here's a rather antiquated document. Since we were talking about secession earlier today, I was mentioning a conversation I had at lunch with our pastor and his reading about secession in the Greenville News in conjunction with the Christian Exodus movement. In Congress, July 4, 1776, the unanimous declaration of the 13 United States of America. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitles them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers on such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. Such has been the patient sufferance of these colonies, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to alter their former systems of government. Well, this is, of course, the first part of the Declaration of Independence, as I stated, that was written by none other than Thomas Jefferson. And since secession came up earlier in the conversation yesterday that I mentioned, as well as the comments that Corey Burnell had made and others in the interviews when it came out in the Greenville Journal and the Greenville News, let's talk about secession for just a quick second. Did Thomas Jefferson just mention secession? Well, I think that he did. He said that we have the right to alter or abolish any government that is responsible for abuses, a long train of usurpation and abuses, and to put in a more fitting form of government for the American colonies. That's what he said. They were willing to secede, to declare an independence from the whole British Empire. British rule, the British crown. There's no difference between what Jefferson said and what the Christian Exodus movement wants to do. They believe that George W. Bush, that Bill Clinton, that the United States Congress, that the federal court system, and all of the rest of the of government has gone against the fundamental principles of the found in the Constitution, that they've gone against and gone astray when it comes to the principles of liberty declared in the Declaration of Independence, the idea of inalienable rights, when it comes to respecting private property, when it comes to respecting life and not aborting unborn children, when it comes to forcing people to be conscripted against their will into armies and to fight insane wars for no good purpose in other lands, aggressing people we have that have not aggressed us, and forcing people to fight in that war in a form of slavery. They believe, rightly so, that the federal government of the United States has violated the great provisions and principles that made this country great. We believe that. They believe that, and we believe that here at the Tyranny Response Network. And therefore, they're saying instead of continuing with the federal government as it stands and the Union of States, let us go. Let us secede. Let us take South Carolina and be on our own, an independent nation, able to accomplish self-government and promote the ideals in which they think the Founding Fathers established this great country. That's what secession's all about. It's not a radical concept in the sense that it's never been heard of in history. As a matter of fact, it has been heard of in history. It's been part and parcel of our government and our people since the very beginning, especially since 1776 when we seceded from Great Britain. The South also tried to secede. Of course, we know the terrible outcome of that with Lincoln aggressing the South and forcing the South to stay in the Union. New England almost seceded before that and at the last minute decided not to. There's no question about their ability to secede at the time or the rightness of their secession. It's only become in recent years that the thought of secession sounds insane. But that's simply because people have not read the Declaration of Independence or believed the words of Thomas Jefferson to be true. Remember what he says, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive to these ends, to uphold these rights, that is, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it and institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. So we either believe Jefferson or we believe what the public school teaches or the modern media. You're listening to Christian Worldview with Dr. John Coben. We'll be back in just a minute.
Hello, this is Dr. John Coben. Get a copy of Bible and Government, Public Policy from a Christian Perspective, my latest book. You can buy it online from Alertness Books. The link is at the top of policyofliberty.net. That's www.policyofliberty.net. It's only $11, and it will help you think about the Christian's relationship to public policy and the nature of the state. Be sure to get a copy today of Bible and Government, Public Policy from a Christian Perspective.
Warning. Dr. Coben's show is not recommended for anyone with an aversion to deep thinking and critical analysis.
If you have a question or comment for the show, please dial 864-244-8177. That's 864-244-8177. You may also dial 864-201-6955. That's 864-201-6955. Or you may email your question or comment to questions@policyofliberty.net. That's questions@policyofliberty.net. And remember, the show is live from 7:30 in the morning until 9 in the morning Eastern Time. If you're listening at any other time you're listening to a recording, calls will only be received between 7:30 and 9 in the morning Eastern Time. This is Dr. John Coben. Visit policyofliberty.net. That's www.policyofliberty.net on the web. You'll find there books and articles written by Dr. John Coben, that's me, the Tyranny Response Unit, regarding things related to covenant marriage, allodial land titles, and free market economics. You'll also find there portraits of famous economists, including their biographical information and links to their famous works, as well as many, many quotations for liberty. Visit policyofliberty.net on the web today and find a wealth of information to help advancement of the truth.
Mr. Speaker, I want someone on that side of the house to tell me the difference between the bold robber who holds you up on the highway and robs you of your money and the government that does the bidding of a band of robbers who prescribe the conditions by which you shall come in and surrender your money. I will tell you the difference. One takes his chances and runs the risk of losing his own life in his effort to rob others, while the other gang uses the governmental machinery to hold up and plunder the citizen and, in the name of law, commits his crimes against humanity. Congressman James T. Heflin, Alabama, 1909.
Liberalism is not to be tossed lightly aside, but to be hurled with great force.
And I was just reading a couple of things about, well, during the break here, about this Justice Roberts. Really don't know a whole lot about him, so I'm not going to, unless you guys want to talk about him and give us a call, we could be happy to do that. But unless you do, I think we don't really have much need to discuss what's going on with Roberts today, just because we don't know a whole lot about him. It says here that he represented clients such as the National Collegiate Association in a discrimination case and a car maker, Toyota, winning limits on disabled workers' claims. Well, that's good. It sounds like he's trying to restrict there, or arguing in favor of restricting the rights of welfare state policies, behavior-changing policies, proactive policies that the federal government doles out. At any rate, there seems he went to Harvard. Can I hold that against him? He's also from Buffalo, New York. I guess we could hold that against him. Anybody from Buffalo, New York, don't be offended. Just kidding. At any rate, it says one of the least contentious picks for the Supreme Court that Bush had on his plate. Interesting to see what actually transpires as they begin to uncover more about him. Well, here's an article about from LouRockwell.com, "Support Our Troops or Shut Up, Please," by Jack Kenney. Patriotism may not always be the last refuge of a scoundrel, as Samuel Johnson claimed, but it is often the first substitute for thought, and mindless patriotism in time is often expressed with the bumper sticker exhortation, "Support Our Troops." And let me skip down through the article a little bit. He says, "It's grossly unfair, uncommon for supporters of the war to question the loyalty of even the parents or spouses of those killed in battle if they bereaved dare to question or oppose our government's self-appointed mission in another far-off land. What is seldom remarked upon is how thoroughly the deck has been stacked in any public debate about war. Those who unfailingly support any war our rulers choose to prosecute are always patriots." And skipping on, he says, "The irony is that America is at war, is always defending our freedom. Though how our freedom might have suffered if we had not invaded and occupied Iraq is not quite clear. In the most patriotic state I can imagine, South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham recently told Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, people are beginning to question. It would be more than refreshing, it would be downright patriotic if Americans in all 50 states began to question military decisions of our leaders before we are 2 years into a war with no way out." It is by, he closes by saying, something from Mark Twain, "It is by the goodness of God that we have in this country those three unspeakable precious things, freedom of speech, freedom of conscience, and the prudence never to practice either of them." That's cute. Well, at any rate, this is a great thing to bring up here, because we are concerned about the war in Iraq. We're concerned what might be transpiring over there, because it looks like it's a war of aggression, not a war of self-defense, a just war. It's something that we should not be participating in, and we're concerned about that. At any rate, another article, just trying to get through one more before we go to a break here. OrangeCountyRegister.com has an article from Stephen Greenhut, and he basically says, "Last week, Orange County Register readers were treated to one of those small stories that says volumes about government officials, their priorities, and the way they constantly waste your tax dollars to promote their own well-being and their own agendas. It's often small examples that tell big stories, which is why public yawns when the government wastes billions of dollars but gets outraged when, say, a city council member names a park after himself, or when the Navy spends $1,000 for a toilet seat. The public appears to be outraged at Orange County Sanitation District General Manager Blake Anderson after the Register printed a front-page article entitled, 'Orange County Has Joined the Sewage of Enlightenment.' Reporter Terry Sforza details the Sanitation District's $570,000 expenditure in a little more than 3 years to management consultant who specializes in booing workplaces with what can barely be described as New Age spirituality." Yeah, they would be upset. And, you know, growing up in Orange County, this is a very much a conservative or libertarian area. The Orange County Register is that kind of a paper. It's one of the only ones in America that could be described that from a major metro area. But at any rate, he says at the end of the article, "Government agencies cannot be reformed because there is no bottom line. There's no going out of business. There's no competition. There's a plenty of political influence. By all means, be outraged at the never-ending waste of the state, fraud and abuse that emanates from government, but don't be incredulous when guys like Anderson raise your rates to help you pay for gurus. that it's to promote New Age spirituality. Very interesting stuff, and we appreciate the interesting comments from the research staff they send up to us. You've been listening to Christian Worldview with Dr. John Coben. We'll be back for just a few minutes after the upcoming break.
Response Network. It's roughage for your brain.
This is Dr. John Coben from Christian Worldview. You know, a lot of my listeners call and ask me about allodial land titles, covenant marriage, and other topics of importance to Christians who love liberty. Many of these things I've written about at the policyofliberty.net bookstore called Alertness Books. We invite you to visit the Alertness Books bookstore today and pick up the materials that will help you learn the truth and be free.
The Patriot Network is a national federation of local clubs devoted to bringing relief to the oppressed American taxpayer. It is based right here in the South Carolina Upcountry and chaired by Dr. John Coben's associate, legendary freedom warrior Robert Clarkson. Visit our website at patriotnetwork.info for full contact information, meeting times, and locations around the South and beyond. That's Patriot Network, one word, .info. There you can also sample many action reports, current and past issues of our newsletter, and mainstream news features about IRS rot, corruption, and incompetence. Find out what our decades-old organization may be able to do to put a stop to your IRS problems. PatriotNetwork.info commends Dr. John Coben on the founding of the Tyranny Response Network and his unique Christian Worldview show, heard weekday mornings right here on TRN.
If you have a question or comment for the show, please dial 864-244-8177. That's 864-244-8177. You may also dial 864-201-6955. That's 864-201-6955. Or you may email your question or comment to questions@policyofliberty.net. That's questions@policyofliberty.net. And remember, the show is live from 7:30 in the morning until 9 in the morning Eastern Time. If you're listening at any other time, you're listening to a recording. Calls will only be received between 7:30 and 9 in the morning Eastern Time. Hello, this is Dr. John Coben. Get a copy of Bible and Government, Public Policy from a Christian Perspective, my latest book. You can buy it online from Alertness Books. The link is at the top of policyofliberty.net. That's www.policyofliberty.net. It's only $11, and it will help you think about the Christian's relationship to public policy and the nature of the state. Be sure to get a copy today of Bible and Government, Public Policy from a Christian Perspective.
Warning, Dr. Coben's show is not recommended for anyone with an aversion to deep thinking and critical analysis.
Liberalism is not to be tossed lightly aside, but to be hurled with great force.
Sick of having the dead flies of bad public policy stink up the ointment of American liberty? The follies and foibles of the political sages of our day are plucked out daily on Christian Worldview with Dr. John Coben, weekday mornings from 7:30 to 9 o'clock, right here on 97.7 FM in Greenville.
This is Dr. John Coben. Visit policyofliberty.net. That's www.policyofliberty.net on the web. You'll find there books and articles written by Dr. John Coben, that's me, the Tyranny Response Unit, regarding things related to covenant marriage, allodial land titles, and free market economics. You'll also find there portraits of famous economists, including their biographical information and links to their famous works, as well as many, many quotations for liberty. Visit policyofliberty.net on the web today and find a wealth of information to help advancement of the truth. The Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments of the American Constitution. Amendment 1. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedoms of speech, or of the press, or of the right of the people peaceably to assemble, and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Amendment 2. A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, shall not be infringed. Amendment 3. No soldier shall, in time of peace, be quartered in any house without the consent of the owner, nor in time of war, but in a manner to be prescribed by law. Amendment 4. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue, but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. Amendment 5. No person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on presentment or indictment of a grand jury, except in cases arising in the land or naval forces or in the militia when in actual service in time of war or public danger, nor shall any person be subject to the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb, nor shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. Amendment 6. In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury of the state and district wherein the crime shall have been committed, which district shall have been previously ascertained by law, and to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation, to be confronted with the witnesses against him, to have compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in his favor, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense. Amendment 7. In suits at common law, where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved, and no fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise re-examined in any court of the United States than according to the rules of the common law. Amendment 8. Excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted. Amendment 9. The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. Amendment 10. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively, or to the people.
Welcome to Christian Worldview with Dr. John Coben. Dr. Coben is an author, columnist, financial planner, and international lecturer. He holds a Ph.D. degree in public policy, M.A. degrees in economics and business economics, and is a graduate of Reformed Bible College. Dr. Coben is an outspoken critic of public schools, government regulation, the IRS, paper money, welfare, and abortion. An evangelical Christian and the father of six homeschooled children, Dr. Coben is applauded by listeners across America and around the world as a champion of liberty, limited government, free markets, and peace. Now let's join Dr. Coben with Christian Worldview.
And we welcome you back to Christian Worldview. Greenville, Spartanburg, 75 degrees. Greenville downtown, also 75, as is Anderson. And Clemson, 74 degrees. Today, partly cloudy. Patchy fog this morning, scattered showers and thunderstorms this afternoon. Humid with highs in the lower 90s. That means it'll be 100 again, if it seems to mean. Southwest winds around 5 miles per hour. Chance of rain, 40%. A perfectly miserable day, unless you like really hot summer, humid, sticky weather. I don't. But at any rate, make your way out to your cubicle and you'll be fine in that climate-controlled environment. Want to spread the word about one thing here, if we can, debunking Darwin conference. Please spread the word about Scientists Who Find Darwinism Unconvincing conference, featuring 8 top scientists that will be in Greenville, South Carolina, August 4th, 5th, and 6th. There are reduced registration fees for students and teachers, including homeschoolers. A further discount of $20 is available if the attendee writes a CSG in the comment box on the registration form at www.piedmonttravel.com. That's www.piedmonttravel.com. Hope you can go there and hear speakers like Michael Behe and Jonathan Wells, as well as Thomas Woodward, as they present the latest scientific data which debunks Darwinism. And so we want to make sure that we encourage that. The Debunking Darwin Conference. Definitely want to know about that event. Also want to remind you tomorrow night that there is a special meeting of the Institute on the Constitution in the dark about cultural issues, about differences in political parties, about the Constitution of the United States, about NAFTA, CAFTA, FTAA. The South Carolina Constitution Party invites you to a gathering of constitutionally minded people Thursday, July 21st, 2005, 7 p.m. at the Augusta Rhodes Branch Library, 100 Lydia Street in Greenville, South Carolina. Call 242-4474. That's 864-242-4474. If you want more information about the Constitution Party meeting coming up. And we want to also remind you about TyrannyResponse.com. TyrannyResponse.com is the website of the Tyranny Response Network, as well as the Christian Worldview program. It has a lot of our audio files. In fact, the audio link there will have not only today's show, yesterday's show, and shows 2 days ago put on there, but you'll have, in addition to that, the special shows on the Memorial of Villainy we did on Memorial Day, the interview with Chuck Baldwin, as well as the Romans 13 and 1 Peter 2 special broadcast. There are Liberty Minutes programs relating to the Christian's view of the state and the Christian view of public policy, what it should actually be, what Christian's reaction to public policy should be. There are Liberty Minutes audio recordings on politics and political theory, as well as key political issues like how to deal with drugs or marriage licenses, marriage covenants, and many other things related to the Christian faith. There's an events tab that also has a calendar at the bottom that tells you what's going on in the upstate. It should also remind you that tomorrow night the League of the South will be meeting at 6:30 p.m. at the Prime Sirloin Restaurant in Greenville, across from the Greenville Mall on Woodruff Road. It's a conflicting meeting this month with the South Carolina Constitution Party, but nevertheless, I hope that some people will be able to attend the League of the South. I'm going to try to be there and encourage those folks on, as they're a great group doing a great cause. And we want to remember all our other friends there. The Related Media tab shows you the Times Examiner, for instance. The Times Examiner is the conservative voice of the Palmetto State. And if you're tired of reading liberal columnists, remember that the Times Examiner supports home and Christian schooling, limited government, free markets, private property rights, gun ownership, Christian values, and our great Southern heritage. You can pick up a copy at the Times Examiner newsstands around Greenville or at their offices located at 44 Pine Knoll Drive. Subscriptions only $25 a year in-state, $27 out-of-state. Call 864-268-0576 to get a subscription, 864-268-0576. All of this information I've mentioned and much more is available at the TyrannyResponse.com or TyrannyResponse.net website. We hope that you'll take an opportunity to visit there and get acquainted with what's going on in the upstate in terms of public policy, in terms of being an active Christian in your society, or in terms of just learning about the Christian perspective on public policy and what the Scripture teaches about how Christians should be involved in these kinds of things. We're glad you joined us this morning for Christian Worldview. As I said earlier in the show, unfortunately, we have no producer today. And trying to fly here solo and just not going to be able to do that today. But instead, what we're going to do for the remainder of the show is I'm going to see if I can't take a quick pause here and turn on for us a couple of Liberty Minutes, which are very important Liberty Minutes. One on libertarian social policy, which relates largely to our discussion yesterday about what public policy should the state be involved with and what the Constitution Party and Libertarian parties think about it, specifically the Libertarian Party on this issue. And after that, I want to play for the remainder of the show the long Liberty Minutes on the Christian views on rebellion. And we'll try to go forward from there. And you say, well, Christian views on rebellion, that's rebellion's wrong. Well, stay tuned. You'll find out what the Christian views are of people like King George telling us we're in rebellion for revolting and whether Christians should have taken part in the American War for Independence. It's a very didactic piece. Be prepared to put your thinking caps on, and we certainly hope that you enjoy it. Again, I'd like to thank you for listening to the live part of Christian Worldview this morning with Dr. John Coben. Look forward to seeing you back right here again tomorrow. Now, if you'll just bear with me for a moment, I'm going to go ahead and try to turn this on. It might be a moment of silence while I do.
And now, here is Dr. Coben with today's edition of Liberty Minutes.
Many Christians criticize libertarians for allegedly promoting a libertine and hedonistic or immoral social policy. But what exactly is libertarian social policy? This is Dr. John Coben with Liberty Minutes. Social policy is a finer name for state-mandated wealth redistribution, social justice, or legislation of morality and behavior modification schemes. Libertarianism has no social policy, even though some might misguidedly classify as promotion of individual liberty and the protection of fundamental rights as social policies. Libertarianism supports the natural rights to life, liberty, and property, very limited government, freedom of speech and religion, and a capitalist economy unbridled by regulation. On a local level, libertarians rely on private contracting, that is, restrictive covenants, the common law, and time-honored customs to form the rules that guide social interaction. Libertarianism's underlying basis is the principle of non-aggression against any innocent human being by both individuals and governments. Libertarians oppose proactive policies instituted by states, universal health care, public schools, the war on drugs, gun control, welfare and social security, environmentalist social policies, progressive income taxation, the Federal Reserve System, the draft, slavery, and aggressive wars, just to name a few policies. See http://www.lp.org/issues/issues.shtml. The Libertarian Party website states, "The Libertarian Way is a logically consistent approach to politics based on the moral principle of self-ownership. Each individual has the right to control his or her own body, action, speech, and property. Government's only role is to help individuals defend themselves from force and fraud. Social policy is simply not on libertarianism's approved list, nor does personal preference translate into social policy. The fact that some libertarians are drug abusers and sodomites does not mean that libertarianism champions drug use or sodomy as social policy. The personal philosophies espoused by eccentric libertarians, those with hedonistic or immoral lifestyles in particular, should not be confused with the ideal or core libertarianism. For instance, to pro-life libertarians, the non-aggression principle means that the pro-life position is the only consistent libertarian one. Visit Libertarians for Life at www.l4l.org. Even though 60% of libertarians favor abortion rights, regrettably, many libertarians are inconsistent on the pro-life issue, just as the libertarian Thomas Jefferson was inconsistent on the slavery issue. Yet such personal inconsistency does not make libertarianism inconsistent. Moreover, just because something is sinful does not mean it should be illegal. Libertarians do not seek to use the state to enforce morality or change the moral conduct of citizens. Libertarians rely on acts of civil society, what economists refer to as market-based phenomenon, such as gospel preaching to change behavioral preferences rather than the state. Libertarians hold that government should protect us from predators so that our fundamental rights are preserved. Only then is there an overlap with commandments of God like, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, and you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor, Exodus 20:13, 15-16. From a libertarian perspective, government does not enforce these laws because God says to do so. Instead, the ideal of government upholding fundamental rights by protecting people from predators is seen as the best means of promoting a civil society under pluralism. The Constitution is safeguarded by applying a strict or non-living interpretive rule. Prosperity, social cooperation, ingenuity, and relative peace are the result. For many Christians, the ideals of libertarianism are compatible with the Bible. Activist, principled Christians will fall into one of two groups, aptly represented by the Constitution Party and the pro-life wing of the Libertarian Party. The former camp tends to be more comfortable with a theonomic public policy theology, the latter camp with a liberty of conscience theology. Although some variation will occur within each camp, a consistently thinking Christian will inevitably land in one of the two camps once he decides what the nature of the state is and what its purpose is in the world. But no one should make the mistake of concluding that libertarianism fosters a proactive social policy. An activist, liberty-minded Christian should express tolerance and an open ear to the issues raised by other activist Christians, especially after they understand the presuppositions of the two camps. The former tend to be Presbyterians and the latter Baptists, although the denominational lines are not that sharp in terms of public policy theology today. Interestingly, while no Baptists signed the Constitution, they were keenly interested in the Bill of Rights. A Christian's public policy theology will drive him to one camp or the other if he is consistent. For example, if a Christian believes that the state is potentially good, ordained by God, along with the church and the family, to promote righteous living and help advance the kingdom of God through the dominion mandate, Genesis 1:27, he will land in the Constitution Party camp. Alternatively, if a Christian believes that the state is by nature evil, only ordained by God in the same way that Satan is ordained by God, he will land in the pro-life libertarian camp. The proactive state represents a competing kingdom opposed to God's kingdom, rewarding those whom it considers good, that is, violators of God's commands, and punishing those whom it considers evil, that is, Christians. Furthermore, libertarian Christians, see www.libertarianchristians.org, will tend to not be postmillennial, viewing pluralism as a permanent state of affairs until Christ returns, that is, always more tares than wheat, Matthew 13:24-43. So how does one's public policy theology work itself out in terms of political activism? In reality, the two camps have much in common, and they are able to combat common foes quite well. Both sides take an active role in transforming their world. Both hate socialism, state-sponsored perversion of morality and justice, economic intervention and regulation of business, licensing, etc. Their relatively minor differences appear when considering how to deal with national problems and policies such as illegal immigration, drugs to a lesser extent, and posting the Ten Commandments. In other words, while libertarians have no social policy, those in the Constitution Party camp have room for a little of it, as their platform indicates. And this has been Dr. John Coben with Liberty Minutes. To find out more about Liberty Minutes, please visit www.tyrannyresponse.net or www.policyofliberty.net.
And now, here is Dr. Coben with today's edition of Liberty Minutes.
Have you considered the various Christian views on the reasons for resistance or rebellion? This is Dr. John Coben with Liberty Minutes. A preacher recently proclaimed, "Rebellion against authority is rebellion against God." Another pastor once told me, "If it's illegal, it's sinful. He must be thankful for much grace to cover his sins of disobedience to the state in light of all the legislation he inadvertently violates." And a recent caller to my radio show said something like, "Once a proposal becomes the law, a Christian must obey it," implying that disobedience is sin. These Tory principles are widely held by American Christians. But is such sentiment correct? Is resistance to tyrants, which they call rebellion, necessarily sinful? Rebellion against God is certainly always wrong. It is condemned in the Scripture as being analogous to witchcraft, 1 Samuel 15:23. Having a rebellious attitude or to despise authority is likewise an acceptable Christian practice, 2 Peter 2:10, Jude 1:8. The Bible teaches that Christians are to be subject to the governing authorities, which are appointed by God, Romans 13:1, and to submit to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, both in the case of kings and lower magistrates or governors, 1 Peter 2:13. Nevertheless, the civil ruler submission doctrine is surely qualified. No Christian theologian has ever held that the New Testament requires absolute submission to every civil government decree. Even the apostles disobeyed civil authority when they believed obedience to it would cause disobedience to God. They resisted tyranny by obeying God and were thus wrongly considered rebels. No Bible-believing Christian should consider the commands in Romans 13, 1-7, 1 Peter 2, 13-17, and Titus 3:1 to be absolute. Indeed, taking into account the whole counsel of God, it is clear that God's people have not and should not submit themselves to every ordinance of man in an absolute sense. The Egyptian midwives defied Pharaoh's decree to murder infants, Exodus 1:15-21. Ehud acted against public policy by deceiving the king's ministers and then slew the king, Judges 3:15-26. Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refused to comply with public policies that mandated religious rituals contrary to proper worship, Daniel 3:8-18, 6:6-10. The wise men from the east disobeyed Herod's direct order to disclose Jesus' whereabouts, Matthew 2:7-12. Peter and John forthrightly disobeyed the ordinance of man that mandated that they desist from preaching, Acts 5:28-29. Judging from these biblical premises, therefore, the foremost doctrinal issue for a Christian theology of public policy is apparently not whether Christians may ever disobey state decrees, but rather when civil disobedience by Christians becomes mandatory, or, further, when obedience becomes optional or discretionary for a Christian who must be free to act within the parameters of his conscience. Indeed, the core question boils down to when or at what point civil disobedience is justified, and what test must be applied to determine when such rebellion is righteous. Remember, civil disobedience and rebellion to the state are synonymous terms, the former being the patriot's perspective, and the latter the tyrant's. At many points over the course of history, rebellion has been widely held to be a good thing and has thus been proclaimed by church leaders. Their message has been simple and straightforward. To disobey tyrants is to obey God. So it was at the founding of the United States of America. In the 1770s, American Christians viewed British public policies as grounds for armed resistance. The colonists not only believed that they had a right to resist British tyranny, they held that submission, or not rebelling, would have been sinful. Thus, preachers incited revolution. The arguments advanced by preachers of the day in support of this sentiment were manifold. First, Parliament had set itself up in an idolatrous manner by claiming sovereignty in all cases whatsoever over the colonies, and it was blasphemy to think that mere human beings could ever have such authority. Indeed, Reformed colonists wanted to preserve their identity as a covenant people, and Parliament's claims represented both tyranny and idolatry, because honoring the claims of the king would be tantamount to forsaking God, who says to have no other gods before him. Second, the vibrant church in the wilderness of America represented the New Israel, while the king and his cronies represented a satanic onslaught aimed at harming God's chosen people, thus giving Christians a rationale for self-defense against the civil authority. Third, Christians have a right to be free from tyranny, citing Galatians 5:1, along with the means to redress grievances regarding unfulfilled expectations in or violations of colonial charters and basic human rights. And, more implicitly, fourth, the abuses of life and property which emanated from King George III in Parliament, including their undertaking legal plunder of the colonies, justified self-defense. The civil authority could be resisted in the same way that a homeowner resists a robber or a businessman withstands a thug. This thesis highlights the actions of the American founders, Christian ones in particular, in endeavoring to showcase the various historical Christian theologies of public policy. While many of us believe that the founders were right in rebelling, many other Christians disagree. Thus, it is worthwhile to discuss the interaction and intersection of faith and civil disobedience, especially in light of the rising onslaught of modern public policies against Christians. Part 2. The Bible indicates that being a revolutionary can bring temporal trouble. My son, fear the Lord and the King. Do not associate with those given to change via revolution, for their calamity will rise suddenly, and who knows the ruin those two can bring. Proverbs 24:21-22. When the Jewish religious leaders were furious with the apostles for preaching the gospel, Gamaliel reminded his council about the failed revolutionary attempts of Theudas and Judas of Galilee and their men, most of whom were executed by the civil authorities, Acts 5:33-39. Not all revolutionary attempts fail, of course, but the probability of success is low, and the likelihood of imprisonment or death for treason is high. As Gamaliel said, if a revolutionary movement is of God, it will stand. Otherwise, it will fail. And the general counsel of the Bible is that if one wants to preserve his life, he had better think twice about being a revolutionary. The founding fathers knew what they were getting into in opposing the world's most powerful empire. Their commitment was summed up in the closing language of the Declaration of Independence, and for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. The founders who read Proverbs 24:21 evidently viewed it as mere practical advice about avoiding temporal consequences rather than as a general directive to be obeyed in all cases. And their resulting successful revolt was extraordinary, being aided by many symbiotic cultural dynamics of the time. Still, Proverbs 24:21-22 and Acts 5:33-39 provide a constant reminder to Christians to beware of participating in revolution. Indeed, What was practical for the founders might not be prudent for us today. Moreover, the Bible indicates that the motive for submitting to civil authority is to glorify God, to avoid worldly distractions that detract from the church's main mission, and that Christians may lead a quiet and peaceable life, 1 Timothy 2:2. At least in the short term, revolution would seem to be counterproductive to evangelism and building the church. In order to meet such biblical objectives, Christians may have to be practical or expedient when confronted by the civil authority. The Bible counsels that when eating with the ruler, put a knife to your throat if you are a man given to appetite, Proverbs 23:2. Jesus told Peter to fetch a coin from the mouth of a fish, not because he had been worried about his unpaid tax liability, but because he did not want to offend the civil authorities, Matthew 17:27. Jesus knew that the tax had not been paid, and yet had apparently expressed no concern about breaking the rules. Perhaps this event formed part of the rationale that led the Pharisees to accuse Jesus of forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, Luke 23:2. At any rate, avoiding confrontation in general is important for a Christian. This ideal is the driving force behind the Apostle Peter's wide admonition, honor all people, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king, 1 Peter 2:17. The American founders sought to avoid confrontation with King George III, and only after what Thomas Jefferson called a long train of abuses and usurpations did they choose to rebel against him. Would the apostles have rebelled against Rome at some point too? Surely, Nero was every bit as evil and defiant as King George III, and yet the apostles did not rebel against Nero. Perhaps they would have done so, at least if they had the arms and soldiers to pull it off. Compare Luke 14:31. The war for American independence was fought over a fundamental issue of authority, specifically the place where the consent of the governed rested, and who was entitled to rule. In 1775, there was widespread doubt about the legitimacy of centralized power exercised from London. Apparently, the Christians in the 1770s believed that civil disobedience and armed revolution were justified and prudent so long as a good or godly reason could be found for such revolt, and as long as the insurgents were backed with sufficient firepower to have a decent shot at success. The scripture is silent, or at least not conclusive, on whether Christians can revolt against the state when they have the means to do so. We do not know what Paul and Peter would have done or taught if pro-Christian forces were able to muster sufficient resources to defy Nero. Yet the scriptures seem to indicate that Christians have a right of self-defense, Luke 22:36, which could be taken as a right of defense against both criminals and state plunderers like King George III, or George W. Bush for that matter. Or should we simply believe that apostolic teaching regarding submission to and honoring of civil rulers prohibits Christians from ever defending themselves against them? Must Christians never attack civil rulers, no matter how tyrannical the state becomes or how much it plunders its citizenry? I don't think so. The Tory preacher's view, rebellion against authority is rebellion against God, is wrong while the founding fathers' actions were right. King George III was an overbearing thief and a depriver of civil liberties. Since the colonists had the power to resist, they were rightly exhorted to do so, especially considering the implications of 1 Corinthians 7:21-24. For some of us, no further justification is needed to attack a wayward, tyrannical, and predatory state beyond the fact that it is plundering us or depriving us of our liberties. Like a robber or other criminal, the state can be opposed when it is prudent and possible to do so. Other willing Christian insurgents, however, need further validation. For instance, many preachers and theologians in the 1770s proclaimed that Romans 13, 1-7 and 1 Peter 2, 13-17 were binding only insofar as government honors its moral and religious obligations. Otherwise, the duty of submission was nullified. Indeed, rulers had no authority from God to do mischief. It was blasphemous to call tyrants and oppressors the ministers of God, and each individual was left to decide when a ruler crossed the line. In the final analysis, using either of these methods to justify civil disobedience leads to the conclusion that state tyranny can be properly resisted by Christians. Indeed, Christians are remiss who do not oppose tyrants. Part 3. According to a public policy theology popular among evangelicals, the American founders sinned greatly by rebelling against their earthly sovereign, King George III. Why? Let's consider a few of the sins committed by the American founders and their associates. On June 9, 1772, the British revenue cutter Gaspy ran aground near Providence, Rhode Island. The hated and feared anti-smuggler, Lieutenant Duddingston, was put ashore along with his crew. And on the next morning, the Gaspy was burned by a group of patriots led by Adam Whipple. Rhode Island Chief Justice Stephen Hopkins refused to bring the men to justice. Even though the Crown offered a reward for the names of the culprits, no one would turn in Whipple and his men. There was overwhelming public and Christian support for the revolutionary action. Similarly, on October 12, 2000, the USS Cole was bombed by several Arabs who thought that they were fighting for the right cause, killing 17 American servicemen. But should the Arab insurgents be deemed criminals or patriots for their cause? Our tendency is to justify the American insurgents and condemn the Arabian ones, although in the abstract there is not that much difference between the actions of the two bands. Would our view change if the USS Cole had been attacked by Christians in New Zealand instead? The usual American response is that anyone who attacks American interests is wrong. What about the Christian response? Irrespective of nationality or politics. For whatever reason, it seems that there is an underlying moot assumption that what is against America must also be against Christianity. Indeed, it seems that American Christians in 2005 have a more confused public policy theology than their predecessors did some 230 years earlier. By January 1773, dozens of committees of correspondence, political communication conduits that spread news that fostered the revolutionary movement, had been formed in Massachusetts and other places, including Virginia and the Carolinas. These groups actively utilized lively political meetings and printed materials to incite a spirit of rebellion against the king. British governors viewed their actions as treason. But were these colonial Englishmen really criminals and rebellious sinners against the king and God? Or were they courageous and righteous believers defending themselves against a tyrant and thus glorifying God in the process? If Christians have the means and power to rebel against evil, then why shouldn't they do so, to the glory of God? On December 16, 1773, the British ships Dartmouth, Eleanor, and Beaver anchored in Boston Harbor and laden with tea belonging to the East India Tea Company were boarded by about 150 rebels, patriots, disguised as Mohawk Indians. Recalcitrant local merchants were unwilling to accept the cargo since they did not want to pay the import duty imposed on the tea. Congregationalist Christian John Hancock, Boston's richest resident, reportedly led the raiding party that emptied 342 chests of tax-tainted tea worth £18,000 sterling into the sea. The raiders did not destroy any other property on the ships. Were these British subjects, mainly Christian men, who knew what the Bible said about submission to the king, sinning by committing crimes of destroying private property and disobeying the civil authority? If a Boston Tea Party was justifiable Christian action in 1773, why would it not be today? On September 5, 1774, the First Continental Congress was firmly established, being comprised largely of professing Christians. Since the assembly had no basis in English law and could have been held as illegal by the king, its very existence was an act of revolution. May a Christian in good conscience be part of a movement that is considered revolutionary and treasonous by the civil authority? On December 14, 1774, Continental Congressman and attorney John Sullivan led the first military action by 400 colonial minutemen against the British in Portsmouth. Without casualties, they captured Fort William and Mary, seizing the military hardware that the militia would use in future military actions. In January 1775, King George III made clear that he considered such activities rebellious. The New England governments are in a state of rebellion. Blows must decide whether they are to be subject to this country or independent. Parliament responded by ordering troops against the largely Christian residents of Massachusetts. Later, on August 23, 1775, the king issued a proclamation for suppressing rebellion and sedition, whereby he accused the colonists of proceeding to open an avowed rebellion by arraying themselves in a hostile manner to withstand the execution of law and traitorously preparing, ordering, and levying war against us. Do Christians have a right to defend themselves against a king that the sovereign Lord has placed over them? What about Christians rising up with arms against George W. Bush and his cronies? Is there a difference? Does the existence of democratic processes debilitate just revolt? On April 19, 1775, Christians fought against the British in church courtyards in Lexington and on the road to Concord, Massachusetts. In this overt rebellion against civil authority, 49 mostly Christian patriots were killed and another 46 were wounded or missing, while 73 British troops were killed and another 200 were wounded or missing. On June 17, 1775, the Battle of Bunker Hill took place. British forces attacked patriots on Breed's Hill, overlooking the sea approach to Boston Harbor. Nearly half of the British troops, 1,054 of 2,400, were killed or wounded. American Colonel William Prescott told his troops, "Don't fire till you see the whites of their eyes." Is it proper for Christians to take aggressive action against legitimate civil authority? What would we think of a group of Christians led by a modern-day Prescott pointing at a group of ATF agents about to assail them? Does anyone remember the government-led massacres in Ruby Ridge, Idaho in 1992 and in Waco, Texas in 1993? Make Christians fight back against the oppressive state? Is martyrdom the only righteous option in the face of state cruelty? On September 22, 1776, a few months after America declared independence and despite not being recognized by Britain as an independent nation, Captain Nathan Hale said, "I only regret that I have but one life to lose for my country." At the age of 21, he was about to be executed by the British for espionage. Hale was a devout Christian in the Puritan tradition. The king considered him a rebel regardless of whether or not Hale considered his allegiance changed on account of the Declaration of Independence. Did that declaration free Hale and other Christians from their duty to obey the previous civil authority, even though that authority did not recognize the new nation's independence? Who should a Christian obey when two sovereigns are vying for recognition over him as a citizen? These questions may be difficult to answer, but serious Christians must strive to do so. Revolution is never legal. If Christians really want to change the world, they will probably have to break the law at some point. Those who want to be patriots and hope to promote liberty within the political process are living in a fantasy world. States do not yield power voluntarily. Citizens must take rulers to Runnymede in order to have any hope of securing greater liberty. The American founders realized this truth and pursued it with unflinching vigor. We enjoy the benefits of their labors and sacrifices. Let's be bold in likewise defending those liberties just as our valiant forefathers did, putting aside the torpid Tory mindset that would torpedo our freedoms. Part 4. Our Christian forefathers who lived during the 1770s were revolutionaries. Preachers and theologians of the day actively advocated rebellion against the civil authority, and Christians complied, participating in the social and political upheaval. We should consider that the position of Christians in England might have been different. Did English preachers condemn the activities of the colonists in their sermons? No doubt many would have remarked that the American colonists who were rebelling against their king were, sinfully, violating Romans 13, 1-7 and 1 Peter 2, 13-17. Tory pastors in America, Anglican or otherwise, also thought that the rebels, patriots, were in sin, since the king had a divine right to rule. Christians must therefore maintain their allegiance to him. However, these loyalist Anglicans lost their influence in America, being assailed intellectually and otherwise, primarily by Baptists, Presbyterians, German Reformed, Dutch Reformed, French Huguenots, Lutherans, and Congregationalists. Furthermore, during the war for American independence, to who should these divine right Tories have been loyal? A colonial government body or King George III? Looking back, one would be tempted to say, to the colonial government because we know the outcome of the war. But the outcome was hardly clear to Nathan Hale or to King George III. It was not clear to General Benedict Arnold either. He was considered both a patriot and a traitor by both sides during the war. Clearly, colonial victories in upstate New York were achieved by this brilliant general, who later proved helpful to the British. On May 10, 1775, Arnold and Ethan Allen led 200 Green Mountain Boys to capture Fort Ticonderoga on Lake Champlain, confiscating 50 cannon, 2,300 pounds of lead, and a barrel of flints for muskets from the king in order to supply the militia in Boston. He led tremendous military campaigns in New York and Quebec, yet he was mocked by the Continental Congress, and on September 21, 1780, he offered to exchange West Point for 20,000 pounds and a commission as a major general in the British Army. Now here's the tough question. Was Arnold in sin when he joined the Americans, when he joined the British, or on both occasions? He obeyed the civil authority of King George III, but disobeyed American authorities. If the apostles Paul and Peter were Arnold's contemporaries, to whom would they tell him to submit and to honor? Given his duplicity and bad character, was Arnold a Christian? Could he have been righteous in following his conscience at both junctures? A Christian's judgment about how Tories or Arnold should be treated, or about how one should respond to revolutionary movements in general, will depend on his presuppositions regarding the nature of the state and what is entailed in appropriate Christian response to public policy. Christians can be orthodox and evangelical with respect to the fundamentals of the faith and the doctrine of salvation, and still disagree widely in their public policy theology. This doctrinal divergence was manifest between the Christian patriots and the Christian Tories, and it is still seen in modern American Christianity. There are two historical schools of evangelical thought regarding the nature of the state and public policy: A, the integrated authority school, and B, the competing kingdom school. The former school views the state as, at least, a potential ally of the family and the church in establishing or advancing God's kingdom in the world. The state's role may be as small as simply restraining what God thinks is evil, or as large as actively clearing the way for the establishment of true religion in a nation. Some integrated authority adherents believe that a strong nexus between the church and state is necessary for a godly society, where the church preaches to the state regarding what it should enforce and the state upholds the biblical standard it receives via the power of the sword. The latter school views the state, encompassed in the biblical terminology as the kingdoms of this world, running a course that is antithetical to God's. Whether driven by its own cultural norms or Satan himself, the state competes against God. Nevertheless, God holds the ultimate reins on the state and uses it to accomplish certain ends in this world, such as bringing terrestrial judgment upon sinners or sanctifying his church through state persecutions. Perhaps paradoxically, some competing kingdom adherents also view the state as restraining civil evil at times. Both of these schools have two branches or sub-classifications, which make up a total of four Christian perspectives of public policy. The two branches of the integrated authority school are, 1, the theonomy view or Christian Reconstructionism, and 2, the revitalized or reshaped divine right of kings view. These views may be condensed to simply the terms theonomy and divine right. The two branches of the competing kingdom school are, 1, the Anabaptist strict separationist or pacifist view, and 2, the liberty of conscience view. Professor Mark Knoll's work, Christians and the American Revolution, 1977, is especially helpful in forming a historical perspective on these positions. I would also recommend my book, Bible and Government, Public Policy from a Christian Perspective, 2003. The instigators of the American Revolution were largely theonomic Presbyterians and Congregationalists, along with Liberty of Conscience Baptists. These groups took an active role in transforming their world, albeit for very distinct reasons. Let's now examine these four views in greater detail. Part 5. The Integrated Authority School views the state as a special sphere of authority along with the family and the church. The state has a useful purpose in directly advancing the kingdom of God in the world. In his famous Institutes of the Christian Religion, Book 4, Chapter 20, John Calvin stated that the Christian finds himself under two governments, one secular and the other ecclesiastical. The secular or civil government has the obligation to be godly and promote the Christian religion. The ecclesiastical government provides spiritual discipline and administers the sacraments. Since the civil government punishes those who are condemned as evildoers by God's word, they must know God's rules. Thus, in order for the state to know what it should promote and condemn, the church has a responsibility to preach the word of God to civil rulers. Theonomy, or Christian Reconstructionism, forms the first and most sophisticated branch within the integrated authority school. Although its doctrine is far more refined than Calvin's, theonomy, which is almost exclusively reformed, has consistently carried Calvin's ideas. Theonomy embellishes Calvin by including all of the Old Testament laws that are not explicitly repudiated in the New Testament, although there is some disagreement between theonomists about what has been repudiated, for example, dietary rules. Revolution is a proper and useful function so long as an alternative authority structure is preserved in order to maintain a godly quality in civil government. Some of the major evangelical proponents of theonomy include Greg Bonson, Gary North, Russus John Rushdoony, Pastor John Weaver, an outspoken modern American patriot, and John Calvin. Theonomy holds a transformational, active, or involved theology of public policy and is characteristically postmillennial. Theonomists like Greg Bahnsen in his work Theonomy and Christian Ethics, Chapter 19, hold that passages like Romans 13, 1 through 7 apply to an idealized state. For instance, Paul was stepping out of a very practical section of his treatise to the Romans to describe what a good government should be like either now or in some future golden age. Paul was not describing the actual current experience of the Christians in Rome, nor was he reveling in some fancy that Nero was serving the Lord by upholding his law. Instead, he was explaining what a proper civil government should look like in the world, and what it will be like during the postmillennial golden age. Thus, theonomists avoid the problem of reconciling the plain meaning of the text with the fact that Nero was in power by viewing Romans 13, 1 through 7, as an abstraction. The second branch within the integrated authority school is what could be termed the revitalized or reshaped divine right of kings view, denoted simply as divine right for short. Evangelical proponents of this view include Samuel E. Waldron, a leading modern Reformed Baptist, John Eidsmo, a modern theologian and writer on public policy motifs, Pastor John MacArthur, English Baptist John Gill, Charles H. Spurgeon, most likely, and probably Martin Luther, who would otherwise be a theonomist. Recall, too, the Tory preacher mentioned earlier, who proclaimed that rebellion against authority is rebellion against God. He holds a divine right perspective. According to this view, the state is a special sphere of authority along with the family and the church. The state has a useful purpose in directly advancing the kingdom of God in the world, but the parameters under which the state must operate or decree public policy have not been very well delineated theologically. Unlike theonomy, where the state and church are more closely linked, the state serves God directly without necessary intervention from the church, restraining chaos and sin in society. Believers owe allegiance to the state and nation in a way that is tantamount to their allegiance to the local church. The American flag is proudly displayed in church sanctuaries, and pastors fondly commemorate national holidays. The state becomes a sort of oracle of God, although not in a fully inspired sense. Christians must obey virtually any command of public policy as if the decree had come from God Himself. For a divine writer, breaking either the letter of the law or the spirit of the law is sin. For example, speeding, hiring an illegal alien, or not coming to a full and complete stop before the limit line before the stop sign would be morally wrong in nations where such activities are illegal. In the divine right view, the state is benign or even innocuous. Like a television set, the state can be good when good things or men participate in it. But when evil things or men dominate, then the state will become evil. A few favored biblical rules are declared to be within the proper range of civil government function. However, the biblical principles that underlie state rules often end up being an arbitrary selection of favorite behavioral ideals. For example, 1. Enforcing the Ten Commandments, or 2. Just the fifth through the ninth commandments, or perhaps 3. Enforcing all New Testament rules as well as a few Old Testament ones regarding sodomy, bestiality, homosexuality, etc. Unlike theonomists, which are more consistent in selecting what biblical principles apply to the state, the divine writer becomes the arbiter of what is right and wrong in a social sense and, therefore, what particular moral issue should be enforced by the state and which one should be left to church discipline. Revolution and civil disobedience are frowned upon, including the American Revolution and the so-called Civil War. The instigation of either war is widely considered to have been sinful. Hence, divine right holds a passive or non-confrontational view in terms of public policy theology. With respect to apostolic doctrine, divine right seems to have the most difficulty of the four views in avoiding the problem of reconciling the plain meaning of Romans 13, 1 through 7 and 1 Peter 2, 13 through 17 with the fact that Nero was in power. As incredible as it might seem, some argue that Nero was, albeit imperfectly, punishing those who did evil in the sight of the Lord and rewarding those who did well in God's sight. Others seem to have never really thought about the implications of what the words good and evil might mean in the cultural context of Nero's Rome. For my part, I think that the divine right view is an embarrassment for American Christianity. Although it is convenient, amicable, and mollifying, the divine right view is also naive and lacks a cogent and consistent understanding about the nature of the state and the Christian's response to public policy. Part 6. The competing kingdom school views the state as an entity entirely distinct from the church and family insofar as promotion of the kingdom of God is concerned. Some proponents of this school would see the state as benign, although it often rears up its ugly side to assail the church of God. Others would view it as significantly aligned with Satan's kingdom and his efforts in the world. Either way, the state is not a special sphere of authority along with the family and the local church. The first branch of this school is the Anabaptist strict separationist or pacifist view. Leading evangelical theologians of this perspective include Menno Simons, Mark Roth, Harold Bender, and Heinrich Bullinger. Submission is passive for the Anabaptists, and even though rebellion is unavoidable in most lifetimes, as Christians inevitably come into contact with trying public policies, armed revolt is never the role of a Christian. Hence, the Anabaptist holds a passive or non-confrontational public policy theology. However, like divine writers, the Anabaptists do not make a very compelling or consistent case for reconciling the plain meaning of Romans 13:1-7 and 1 Peter 2:13-17 with the fact that Nero was in power. The Anabaptist view is the least sophisticated branch of the competing kingdom school, and at some points, like divine right, is attenuated by some apparent logical contradictions in its structure. For instance, the Anabaptist preacher tells believers that it is sinful to be involved with the state's Social Security plan, running for office, jury participation, military service, or voting because the state is effectively evil. The state is also exposed as the frequent afflicter of the church, persecuting God's people. Yet many of this persuasion hold, paradoxically, that the malevolent state is in some way doing God's bidding by restraining evil in the world and punishing criminals. While Anabaptists view the state as a separate competing kingdom, some even see it as having a satanic nexus, they also see the state, even in Nero's Rome presumably, as an instrument of God to punish criminals or those who do evil in God's sight. This fact is rather odd given that Anabaptists, who are presumably the good guys in general, have suffered more persecution at the hands of the state than perhaps any other Christian group. The second branch of the competing kingdom school may be aptly termed liberty of conscience. Although this term has not been commonly used historically to describe theological views of public policy, many theologians and pastors have held it. Proponents include Baptists at the time of the American War for Independence, such as Isaac Backus, John Leland, and John Wallers, as well as Roger Williams and probably John Bunyan, who at least held the seeds of the liberty of conscience view. Any Christian who holds to a dispensational or a New Covenant Calvinistic perspective of biblical interpretation will tend to embrace this view, along with Baptists in general. Such Christians prize volunteerism and freedom of thought among believers and in society, shunning the notion of using Old Testament law or public policy to coerce people into behaving in a proper manner. For instance, few of them would want to force people to abstain from working on Sunday and to attend church services instead. Few of them would want to enlist the tools of the state to better evangelism by compelling people to hear the gospel. Only God has a right to compel sinners to come to Him, Luke 14:23, Psalm 65:4. The liberty of conscience view is developed and applied in a practical way in my book, Bible and Government, Public Policy from a Christian Perspective, 2003. In the same way that theonomy is the logical outcome of a Presbyterian and postmillenarian theology, liberty of conscience is the logical outcome of a Baptist theology, whether premillennialarian or amillennialarian. More resolutely than its Anabaptist counterpart, liberty of conscience views the state as evil, having a strong link with Satan and his kingdom. Yet Christians are left to their liberty with regard to where and when to resist the state, work within the state, or participate in revolution. Like theonomy, liberty of conscience holds a transformational, active, or involved view of public policy theology. It is morally wrong at times to rebel against the state, but not always. Yet the state is never viewed as something to be transformed, or that can ever become anything other than evil. The state is not a benign entity of the divine writers. Moreover, those who hold a liberty of conscience view have a well-worked-out and cogent view of the words good and evil used in Romans 13:3-4 and 1 Peter 2:13-14. Unlike the divine writers, they do not try to make Nero into an overall bad ruler that nonetheless did imperfectly bring law and order to society. And unlike the Anabaptists, they do not try to impose a godly role on the state as an occasional punisher of criminals. They do not share the theonomic quest to idealize the passages and push them off as a theological abstraction with little practical significance for the Christians at Rome. Instead, they interpret the words good and evil to mean good and evil as defined by the state, or Nero, rather than as defined by God. So a state may consider Christians to be evil and punish them with the sword, as Nero did, while rewarding adulterers, idolaters, and murderers that it deems to be good. The liberty of conscience view, which is my perspective, permits Christians to disobey public policy at times. Even though the general rule is for them to submit to rulers and public policies, Christian submission to civil government must be passive rather than active. The Greek verb, translated be subject in Romans 13:1, is in the present tense passive voice in the original language. Likewise, Paul uses the passive voice in Titus 3:1, as does Peter in 1 Peter 2:13. In other words, Christians are to obey whenever directly called upon to do so, so long as God is not defrauded or any sin committed. But it is not their duty to actively pursue a course wherein they scour the law of the land. They do not need to make sure that they are in compliance with every point of public policy if the state does not directly pressure them to do so. Accordingly, Christians do not sin by violating government rules per se. They sin if their actions sidetrack them from their primary mission, cause harm to a neighbor, or detract from the glory of God. Being unduly harassed by the state for things of minuscule importance from an eternal perspective must not be the primary focus of a kingdom-minded saint. But acts of disobedience to tyrants, even revolution, are both permissible and righteous. Part 7. Not only are the great majority of rulers recorded in the scriptures wicked, they also share certain common immoral character traits. And such bad behavior even arose in otherwise good theocratic rulers. While it is said that anger rests in the bosom of fools, Ecclesiastes 7:9, it also seems to rest in the bosom of kings and other civil authorities. Pharaoh got angry, Genesis 40:2 and 41:10, and King Saul became both angry and displeased, 1 Samuel 18:8, as did King David, 2 Samuel 13:21, and the princes of the Philistines, 1 Samuel 29:4. Good King Asa was likewise affected, being enraged with a seer and oppressing some of God's people, 2 Chronicles 16:10. And King Uzziah was angry with the priests over the divine technicalities of a ritual, 2 Chronicles 26:19. Nebuchadnezzar responded in rage and fury to the faithful Jews, Daniel 3:13. King Ahasuerus' anger burned in him after Queen Vashti refused to obey him, Esther 1:12. Sanballat was angered by the Jews rebuilding Jerusalem's walls and took great indignation, Nehemiah 4:1 and 7. The princes were angry with the prophet Jeremiah, beat him and cast him into prison, Jeremiah 37:15. Herod was exceedingly angry with the Magi, Matthew 2:16. Herod had also been very angry with the people of Tyre and Sidon, Acts 12:20. Herod hated Jesus too and desired to kill him, Luke 13:31. Perhaps political power tends to promote the sin of anger? Or is this tyrannical anger induced from within a ruler by the hateful adversary of good, namely the devil? Instead of being for praise to those who do good, compare Romans 13:3, as many Christians today suppose the civil authorities should be, rulers have proven to be a violent and terrifying foe of good people. From the time of his birth, even Jesus Christ was assailed by bad public policy. For Herod will seek the young child to destroy him, Matthew 2:13. Eventually, the civil authority did abuse Jesus. Then Herod, with his men of war, treated him with contempt and mocked him, arrayed him in a gorgeous robe, and sent him back to Pilate, Luke 23:11. Moreover, since a servant is not above his master, Matthew 10:24, the church also suffered persecution by the hand of the state. Now about that time, Herod the king stretched out his hand to harass some from the church, Acts 12:1. A civil junta of the priests, the captain of the temple, and the Sadducees, Acts 4:1, hated the apostles and had determined to severely threaten them, Acts 4:17 and 29. Enraged, Satan pledged to make war with the church by means of his beast of civil authority, Revelation 12:17 through 13:1. Alternatively, Jesus Christ was never angry. While civil rulers became enraged as a result of self-indulgence and their own lusts and pride, Jesus only assailed other men, for example, harassing the money changers in the temple or mocking the scribes and Pharisees, when zeal to please his Father inspired him. John 2, 14-17. Angry civil rulers throw tantrums when they do not have their way, but Jesus, and all Christians who desire to imitate him, only participate in social upheaval out of zeal for the glory of God. So it was for the Christian founders in America. They fought tyranny for the glory of God. As a result, we enjoy the fruits of prosperity for our lives and the gospel that has been unparalleled in the history of the world. Harry Stout postulates, "When understood in its own times, the American Revolution was first and foremost a religious event." Christianity Today, Spring 1996. At the end of the war for American independence, perhaps 80% of the 2.3 million free Americans attended Protestant churches regularly, with the overwhelming majority being Calvinists. Baptists and Methodists were growing rapidly and would eventually eclipse all other denominations. They dominated Virginia and overwhelmed areas of the South and elsewhere, notably Pennsylvania and Rhode Island, with evangelicalism. And preachers en masse backed the revolt against King George III. Were the faithful sinning? Was the Christian church dreadfully backslidden? Tory preachers affirmed this sentiment and pronounced that God was merely working through and in spite of the sinful actions of the rebellious colonists in order to bring about his purposes. That's euphemistic parlance, meaning, yes, the American colonists sinned, but we still like the results anyway. But perhaps their actions were not sinful. Jesus taught his disciples to not only be concerned about the evil doctrine emanating from false religion, but also to beware of evil public policies of the civil authority. Then he charged them, saying, "Take heed, beware of the leaven and the Pharisees, and the leaven of Herod," Mark 8:15. Herod's leaven was promulgated through wayward public policy. Christians have many enemies in the world, both religious and secular or civil. If the Christian cannot flee, Luke 21:21, then perhaps some of them will have opportunity to defend their families from criminals and tyrants. If they can neither flee nor fight, then they will surely become martyrs to the glory of God, Revelation 2:13. Ultimately, we win. The Bible says that kings of the earth and the rulers take a stand against the Lord and against his Christ, Psalm 2:2 and Acts 4:26. But their actions, as any other action of Satan, are under the control of God's foreordained and predetermined purpose, Acts 4:27 through 28. The Bible teaches that satanic forces hold sway over civil rulers and turn them against God's kingdom. For they are spirits of demons performing signs which go out into the kings of the earth and of the whole world to gather them to the battle of that great day of God Almighty, Revelation 16:14, and compare Revelation 13:1. Nevertheless, civil authorities will not prevail against God or his people. It shall come to pass in that day that the Lord will punish on high the hosts of the exalted ones, and on the earth the kings of the earth, Isaiah 24:21. The day is coming, dear Christian and dear lover of liberty, that you too might join the ranks of the founding fathers in resisting tyranny. Are you really prepared to take a stand against the kings of the earth? If not, now is the time for a paradigm shift in your public policy theology. And this has been Dr. John Coben with Liberty Minutes. To find out more about Liberty Minutes, please visit www.policyofliberty.net.
Been listening to Christian Worldview with Dr. John Coben on TRN. Join us again tomorrow morning right here at 97.7 FM on the Tyranny Response Network for Christian Worldview with Dr. John Coben.